Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Today on the HR Power Hour, we have a great guest, and Peter Lowe has been with us many, many times. He's an employment attorney with Brannon Isaacson, and he's going to be giving us a legal update, the annual legal update that we do every year here on the HR Power Hour. Peter has been seen at the Central Maine Human Resource Association. He does the update for them every year, as well as he does this around the state and speaks everywhere. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, David. It's very good to be back.
Yeah. Well, you know, 2014 was a heck of a year. Certainly, if we talk about from an economic standpoint, it seems to be doing a little bit of a rebound. But in the area of law, in the area of HR compliance, the one thing that is really good about the fact that we have an administration that likes putting out regulations is that there is plenty to talk about.
Yes, there's always plenty for us to talk about. The reality is in 2014, and as you mentioned, I just did an update this week with one of the HR associations in Lewiston Auburn area, is that on the legislative front, and we always do a section saying, what's new in legislation? Well, there's very little, and that's not a very big surprise. It wouldn't be a big surprise on the federal level or even on the state level, because we all know that it's very hard to get any law passed at this point in time. And certainly efforts are made, but both in Augusta and certainly in Washington, we're not seeing any significant new legislation. The one thing that I think is of interest and is worth following right here in Maine, and it follows a pattern of other states, and it addresses this ticklish issue of the social media and employers having access to social media accounts of employees. And the particular issue which the legislature are studying, you know, when
they want to study.
Well, when they're not quite sure or they don't want to handle an issue, they maybe sometimes kick the can down the road, and so they form a committee. And in this instance, there's a committee, I believe, is studying the issue of legislation that would prohibit employers from gathering the social media passwords of their employees or their applicants. This is a classic example of one of those pieces of legislation that is totally unnecessary, in my humble opinion. I'm speaking to a group of maybe 80 employers just the other day, the one I mentioned, and I said, show of hands, who in this room requests the passwords for Facebook from their applicants or from their employees? And of course, nobody raised their hand. But because, you know, the Department of Corrections in, I forget now whether it was Maryland or New Jersey, had the bright idea of doing this, it introduced legislation that was successful in that state, and it sort of crept across the country. And whenever you legislate, you have unintended consequences.
Always.
And, you know, there are perhaps at times good reasons for an employer to be aware or learn about what an employee is doing on social media. So stay tuned on that one. We may see something in the next session. I'm not sure.
You know, it's interesting. Last year, there was a lot of work having to do with the NLRB.
Yeah.
And the EEOC. There are a lot of things that were coming out of those areas. What are some of the things that we should be looking at that may affect us here in 2014?
Yeah, well, you know, not to delve too much into the politics again, but the reason we see a lot of activity from those two federal agencies is because the administration, you know, can't have its legislative agenda passed because of the balance of power in Washington. So instead, both of those agencies have been, in some people's view, very activist in pursuing the agenda that the administration has outlined. So the EEOC has really been, you know, very strong in certain areas. I mean, made certain areas an enforcement priority, and we're seeing no backing off from that. On the NLRB side, the NLRB for a number of years now has made social media and employers' social media policies a primary area of interest, and we may have spoken about this previously.
We did, yeah.
But at a very high level, and your HR folks out here will be pretty familiar with this, they will look very, very closely at any termination that is based on information obtained from social media. So if someone goes online and says, my boss is a jerk, and they're called into the office and told that they can't say that and shown the door, then the NLRB has been known to step in at that point and argue that that's a violation of the employee's protected rights and the employee's ability to engage in what we call concerted activity. And it's a fairly technical area, but it really flows from when someone posts something on Facebook and then coworkers, colleagues start to comment. And when that happens, that could constitute a dialogue between employees that is so-called protected activity. So we're in a sort of a brave new world with some of these social media issues. But the NLRB hasn't hesitated to roll up its sleeves and enter the fray. And so when employers have adopted some broad social media policies that say offensive content or disparaging remarks about your supervisor or coworkers are not permitted, they've come in and said that's too broad. Just the other item that folks should be aware of on the NLRB front are some changes in the regulations and rules that pertain to elections. So this will only have relevance to a small segment of your listening audience, where they may either be facing or down the road be facing union organizing activity. And the NLRB is seeking to expedite the union organizing and election process.
Right.
The term you might have seen is quickie elections, and there's a much shorter period for elections to take place. And the view is that employers in the past have been able to buy time, stall, and influence the outcome of the election. Employers would say, no, we're just exercising our rights to inform our employees about the pros, and certainly in the view of many employers, some of the disadvantages of unionization. So these are the types of changes that we're seeing, at least from on the NLRB level.
Yeah, one of the updates I saw had to do with the ability of the organization, the union organization group, to be able to use email, right, company email, to talk about unionization, and that's going to be protected. And so I had seen that at the end of the year. What's your take on that from a perspective of employers trying to say, well, is there really anything I can do about that, or do I just allow them to do that?
Well, you'll love the answer, but it depends.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. I knew.
It truly does depend. It's a complex subject that probably would merit its own half an hour discussion. But where employers do not regulate the use of their email systems and have broad latitude for employees to use their email systems in all sorts of ways. So if you allow your employees to do some fundraising, run the football pool, do an organizing of the softball team, or, you know, all sorts of different things, then there certainly is an argument that organizers could use, is to say, by not allowing us access when you allow access for all these other purposes is retaliatory, or it's intended to impinge upon our rights. So I do think that employers want to be vigilant and mindful about the use of their systems, also for just good business practices. I mean, if you are at work and, you know, your email starts getting cluttered with, you know, endless personal items, you start to wonder, well, what are we here for?
Right. No, there's no question.
So having discipline around that, making your policies clear, and of course, enforcing your policies. Employees, we all have ample opportunity to use private email accounts for personal items, and I think, you know, that should be strongly encouraged by employers. Of course, then get into the issue of employees spending time at work accessing their personal email accounts and efficiency issues. All things that, you know, Dave, you know, you're not quite as senior as I am, but we remember 25 years ago, or 10 years ago, I guess, where none of this. I had a client call me yesterday about a matter and said, you know, can you look up the file? And I looked up the file, and we had a file for this particular employee back in, it was 94. And I looked through the file. There was no email in the file. And I was communicating with the client and with the opposing counsel largely by correspondence, you know, formally signed, and the copy, a green copy, was kept in the file. It was like looking back at another era. And
it is, in fact, a different era.
Yeah.
There's no question about that.
So, yeah, we can't sit back here now and complain about it or bemoan it, and we have to embrace it, but it certainly is different.
Well, it is. It's a new way of communicating, right? So everything from Instagram to Snapchat, all these different ways that people are communicating now. You know, if you're talking at the beginning of when, you know, CMA was founded, you're talking about total different ways of communicating with executives. I mean, I get messages over Facebook from executives now. That would have never been a thought process 5 years ago. So it is. It's a different world for it.
Right.
And we're talking with Peter Lowe. He's an employment attorney with Braun and Isaacson, and we're going to be right back with more legal update for 2014 that affects you in 2015 on the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. I am pleased to announce a new sponsor for the HR Power Hour, Rudman Winchell Employment Attorneys, based out of Bangor, Maine. Rudman Winchell Employment Attorneys are equipped to provide a full range of legal services necessary to protect their clients' interests in this rapidly evolving world of labor and employment law. With an emphasis on client education through seminars and lunch meetings, Rudman Winchell helps keep their clients up to date on employment law in order to prevent potential conflicts. However, when contested matters do arise, Rudman Winchell Employment Attorneys work as vigorous advocates for their clients, identifying and helping them implement cost-effective solutions. From guidance in preventing claims through mediation and litigation, Rudman Winchell's committed employment and labor law attorneys serve small and large private, public, and municipal employers all around our home state of Maine, New England, and across the U.S. and Canada. Call 207-947-4501 or check them out on RudmanWinchell.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today, of course, we're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney with Braun and Isaacson, and we're going to be talking about a continued update on the 2014-2015 things that are happening legally. Let me ask you a question, Peter. You know, there have been a lot of cases that have been settled here in 2014 that will have effect on the 2015 employment rules and regulations. Tell us a little about some of the cases that you see that are really important that employers, let's start with the federal level, then we'll go to the state level. What's the first one that comes to mind is really critical?
Actually, I'm going to surprise you. I don't think any of them have been really critical, because here's what happens. The Supreme Court will rule on a particular issue, and it will garner a lot of attention, and you'll get the blasts from all of us lawyers about how the world is changing about it. And sometimes, Dave, we can be a little guilty of overstating. And I try to bring it down to the practical level of what, you know, employers here in Maine of all sizes, but let's face it, many of our employees are very small businesses, and what really counts for them. And at least on the federal level, you know, there's been some Supreme Court cases, some Supreme Court cases that relate to the Affordable Care Act. There was a Supreme Court case on the wonderful topic of donning and doffing. You know, that's when you put stuff on and you take it off at the end of the day, but us lawyers like to call it donning and doffing. It sounds better. We can charge more for using those types of
words. Those are big words, yes. I may have to look those up.
Let's say you run a factory or a manufacturing facility, and employees are having to put on protective clothing at the beginning of the day, and you have an issue that relates to whether you pay them or not during that preparatory time. Well, the Supreme Court has ruled on that. But that's a pretty narrow issue. There was a Supreme Court ruling. It was within the last couple of months, and actually involved Amazon. And it was an interesting issue, and I was following it fairly closely because I had been giving advice to some clients on the issue. And it was when your employees finish work and they are going to leave the building, but they may have to go through a security check. And that could happen in a retail environment. Mm-hmm. It could happen in a warehouse environment. It could happen in an office environment, probably less so. But when security is making employees have their bags checked, some form of search. And in fact, Apple have faced a lot of litigation in this area because Apple were doing the same. And the claim brought on behalf of Amazon employees and Apple employees and others was that they were being made to wait sometimes 10, 15 minutes. They were waiting in a line, and they should be paid for that time. And that type of case made its way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court just ruled that, in fact, that was not compensable time. So these are the types of issues that we see come out, and they can have a lot of relevance to a small section of our employer base and maybe no relevance to others. What I do think that employers, particularly employers here, but I would say mid-sized to large employers in Maine, need to be constantly vigilant about our wage and hour issues, because we continue to see a plethora. Thought I'd use that.
Boy, that's a big
word
for you.
Yeah, I thought you look that one up afterwards. All right. We continue to see a bunch of. Is that better?
That's much better. Thank you.
Of class action lawsuits being filed. And most things like that seem to originate from states like California. And there's been a huge amount of litigation in California where employers are sued for wage and hour alleged violations. We're seeing some of those cases make their way east. We're seeing some of those cases here in Maine. And they can be incredibly expensive to defend. And they relate to issues such as, I worked through my break and I wasn't paid. I was using my smartphone before work, after work, and I'm expected to read and review and respond to emails, and I'm not being paid. One employee can make that claim, and that could be a modest amount, but multiply that by 50 or 100 or 500 or 1,000, and you're facing a much larger issue. So we've talked a lot with clients about these wage and hour issues, what are the top areas of vulnerability, what you should be doing in terms of self-audit. And so that has been an issue that certainly we're seeing a lot of activity around. And then some of these cases coming from the Supreme Court are helping give some clarification. There was a case here in Maine that collected a lot of attention in 2014. And I think it's worth talking about, even though, in fact, was not an employment case. It was an education case, and part of our practice and my practice is working with school departments here in the state of Maine and municipalities, but school departments in particular. And it involved the plaintiff is John Doe, so it's not an identified plaintiff against Regional School Unit 26. And I believe that's the school unit for the Orono area, if I'm recalling correctly. Yeah. And it was a case involving a transgender student, biologically, if I'm recalling the facts, was born female and assumed a male identity. And the case made a fair number of headlines, as I said, and worked its way through the courts until there was a ruling from the Maine Supreme Court. And the issue focused on the choice of bathroom. And in our practice, we now see, I'd say, four or five situations that haven't yet blossomed into cases each year from clients where the client is addressing the issue of a transgender employee. And the question almost always arises, what bathroom does the employee get to use? These issues and these cases don't lend themselves to sort of a one-minute distilled answer. But I will tell you, the general thrust of these cases, in this main case in an education environment, is that the individual, the student in that case, or it would be an employee in our context, gets to use the bathroom that is consistent with their gender identity or expression. So in that case, the school department was commended for its efforts to accommodate and be reasonable, but they were found liable. They did not permit the student to use the boys' bathroom. And these are tricky issues.
Yeah, I was going to say, these are those type of issues that, while they're one of, they do have cascading effects across other employers that may not realize that these type of issues happen. And I think we are seeing more of this, right? This is, we talk about a brave new world in terms of the social media. We're also seeing, whether it is transgender, gay, lesbian, or any of that, we're really seeing a shift in public view, right?
Right.
A shift of acceptability,
right?
Which, if you talk 5-10 years ago, that just didn't exist. Yep. Let's be honest about it. But it does still make employers uncomfortable because they are balancing one with the group, right? And that can cause tension within that organization.
Oh, yes, without question. So if, a male employee is identifying as female and is requested to use the women's bathroom, we've certainly had situations where the female employees have approached management and said, I'm not comfortable with that. So then the employer is wrestling with, am I caught between a rock and a hard place?
That's exactly right.
And figuring those things out. What I've certainly learned and advised clients is take your time on those issues, think about them very, very carefully, and have a dialogue. Have a dialogue with the employee who's making the request for accommodation. Some employees will be very amenable to a solution that involves, a standalone sort of gender-neutral bathroom. Then there may be other folks who are more advocacy-focused, and their experience has led them to take a what we might see as a more hardline position, or one that may create more of an issue. I have to say, with the clients that I've advised and worked with, the issue has been worked out. It's been resolved. It hasn't led to a claim, but it's certainly part of our workplace and our landscape, and employers are facing some tough issues at times.
Yeah, there's no question. There was a big case, the LinkedIn case, talking about Fair Credit Act. We've talked about it before, and I think it would be interesting to the audience to understand what this case is all about and how it could affect employers.
The case that you're referring to, it's named Sweet versus LinkedIn, and it's another of these class action lawsuits, which I just referred to in the Fair Labor Standards Act context. This is a case that's sort of an interesting case, and it has not been ruled upon, and quite frequently we see these cases and then they disappear, and that's because they get settled. So it remains to be seen whether or not there will be substantive rulings from the judge in this case that will set some new standards. But at a really high level, I think most of us are on LinkedIn.
No question.
And LinkedIn certainly serves a number of different purposes. If you are a paying member, or I guess you pay the premium for LinkedIn, I understand, I don't have that myself, but I understand it gives you the ability to do some searches. And one of the things that it allows a person to do is to do searches, a reference search for an applicant, and it would reveal through the search the people who have worked with that applicant. So you may then choose to go and contact those people as part of
for a reference
as part of your screening. And you know, one of the problems with references sometimes can be you get three names and they're three friends or three former colleagues. And
you, well, I always say you rarely put down a person on a reference that isn't going to give you a good one.
You shouldn't be.
And I would say from a career standpoint, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, good advice. And this suit has been filed against LinkedIn saying that this is a technical issue, but that LinkedIn is really acting as an investigative agency and therefore the Fair Credit Reporting Act applies. What does that mean for employers? Well, best illustration is if an employer wants to do a background check on you, Dave, I'm looking to hire you, but I want to do a criminal background check. If I go to the state of Maine and I use the state of Maine's database and I do a search and I look to see whether you've got any criminal history, I don't have to give you any notices under the Fair Credit Reporting Act because I'm doing the search myself. If I use one of the many companies out there who provide that as a service, so if I use a third party and I contract with them and they do the search, then I'm using an investigative agency and I have to do some quite detailed technical notices, letters under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And our employer audience out there will, I think, be quite familiar with that now and know that that's fairly burdensome. Mm-hmm. So if all of a sudden we learned that by using some social media tools like LinkedIn that implicated the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that would really change the landscape. So stay tuned on that.
That's interesting. You know, the other part that I've heard from the NLRB and the EOC has to do with...
The OC? Isn't that a...
EEOC. EEOC. has to do with the background checks. Has to do with criminal background checks. Right? And that they're really looking at the way it's done and that so it's not discriminatory.
Yeah.
So have you seen that being something that employers have to actively change the way they're doing background checks at this point? Or is it, again, something we need to watch for 2015?
No. Employers should be either changing the way that they do background checks if they're doing them in certain ways that could run afoul of certainly the EEOC guidelines and some of the litigation that's resulting from that. So let me give you an example. If you're an employer who has decided you're going to do background checks because you had a lawyer say, you should do background checks, then do background checks and you find that someone has criminal history. And you say, you know what? I don't need to hire anybody with a criminal history. I can afford to be selective. So this person, even though it was 25 years ago, even though it was an OUI or it was a misdemeanor of some type, I'm not going to hire that person. The EEOC has taken the position that zero tolerance view is too broad. And the reason they've taken that position is that they will argue, and they'll use some experts to buttress their arguments, that has the potential to have a disparate impact on certain protected groups. Usually that's minorities in certain locations who may have a higher rate of conviction, let's say for drug offenses based upon the location, law enforcement priorities, whatever it is, who knows. And they will argue that by casting the net so wide, you're disqualifying qualified candidates and it's having a disparate impact on, let's say, African-American males by way of example. So the EEOC, and they put this in their guidelines, suggest that the assessment is an individualized one. Now, this is where employers hear two messages that similar to actually ADA issues, that you're supposed to be consistent, you're supposed to treat people alike, yet then we have to be individualized. That makes it tricky. So I've worked with a number of our clients to adapt or create their criminal screening guidelines. So when a conviction shows up, they then use a matrix, and they look and see how long ago the conviction was, what the nature of the conviction was, what the position requires. So if you're in a position that involves dealing with the public and dealing with credit cards, a conviction for fraud or theft or embezzlement may well be disqualifying. It will probably depend how long ago that conviction was. So, you know, what folks out there listening should be cautious about is this blanket exclusion of anybody with a conviction, and make the more connection between the convictions, the timing of the convictions, and the nature of the position.
And I think that's probably the big change, right? That I know a number of companies that have had those broad-based policies for years, and that's the change they need to think about, is what is it that really matters to the position and the work history of that position, what exactly they're going to be doing, and match it up to what the potential problem was at that time, the conviction was.
Yeah, and you will see a 45-year-old applicant who had a serious conviction, maybe a felony, when they were 22. If they are able to demonstrate that, you know, they did their time, they have been gainfully employed since that time, they have rehabilitated, those may all point to an applicant who could be successful.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney for Brown and Isaacson. And we will be right back on News Talk WLLB.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney for Brown and Isaacson, and we're giving an update on the legal things that have happened in 2014 that are going to affect 2015. Peter, and for all those in the audience that don't know, Peter and I have known each other a long time, and we've spoken together quite a bit. So some of the humor you're hearing back and forth, or what he may find humorous, is because of that relationship. So I just want to make sure you're going, wow, that kind of candid. Yep, we are. We have a good time. Right, Peter?
We certainly do, Dave. I mean, I'm very respectful to you, but, you know, it's...
I understand. I understand how this is. By the way, our producer, Debbie Davis, is just cracking up in the studio here. But that's okay. We like to be having fun. That's
well, you okay. know, I'm a big believer that, you know, and you and I do a lot of presentations. I do presentations the whole time. You have to educate. That's why people go. But they also want to be entertained. So a little bit of both, a little levity.
No question.
Can help.
Absolutely. Which is why I do radio.
Right. So your listener out
that's
there can
exactly
enjoy
correct.
It.
That's exactly correct. You know, I think one of the things that would be interesting to the audience is maybe hearing about a horror story. Something that is really, really like, oh, my God, really?
Yeah.
And I know you have one of these stories. So why don't you share that with the audience?
Yeah, I always enjoy other people's pain. So these are not my clients' horror stories, I hasten to add, but there were a couple that caught my eye just recently. Email firings, or maybe a politer word is separations, are, as you might imagine, not a good idea. It is much more preferable and respectful and dignified to talk to somebody in person. But this actually UK-based insurance company, quite a sizable one, decided that it would let go one of its employees via email. And unfortunately, it sent the email to all 1,300 employees. So the message was all 1,300 people were fired. So I conclude that in the end, probably two people were fired. The person who was intended to get the email and the person who probably sent the email.
Yes.
Probably one of your HR colleagues in that instance. So that was a little bit of a
That's
glitch.
That's a bad day.
Yeah. There's Microsoft. Obviously, we all know Microsoft.
We should.
And a big honcho at Microsoft was doing a reorganization. And he sent this very lengthy, wordy communication to the workforce. And it started with the phrase, hello there.
Hello there. That's very British.
Yeah, I don't know whether that may have just been my accent on that one. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, okay.
Well, he said hello there, and he took, I think it was 11 paragraphs of corporate chatter to get to the point that 12,500 people would be losing their job. So first of all, get that message out there fairly early, and again, don't do it through email. But I loved some of the language he used. At one point, he talked about accomplishing this within an appropriate financial envelope, whatever the heck that is.
What does that mean?
But that really meant like we got to save a bunch of money here.
Oh.
And then he said we plan to right-size. This is before he told people they were going to lose their job. But we plan to right-size and start a phased exit. And just the phrase, my own opinion, saying we're going to right size, call it what it is. Now, perhaps don't say we're going to fire you, but we're going to terminate your employment. We're going to end your employment.
Which meant, you're wrong, so you're not part of the right part.
Well, maybe. And you can, folks can just pull that one up online, but a very clumsy, poorly executed message. And the irony there, I'm certain, is that a company of Microsoft's size spent a lot of time and had communication strategists and lawyers and everybody else viewing it. But with hindsight, it dropped like a bomb and did not work at all. So when I was preparing for my presentation the other day, I was a bit curious about the word fired. Do you know where
it came from?
Yeah, do you know the origins of the word fired?
No idea.
Why do we say fired? Well, when everything on the internet is true, so I looked it up on the internet.
Yes, and everything.
And one theory for that, which I really like, I know this is very valuable to your audience.
Critical.
I mean, this is something that hopefully you're taking notes while you're listening to this part of it.
If you're going to be playing a game tonight of Trivial Pursuit, this will be helpful.
Exactly, this is helpful. So a corporation, NCR Corporation, do you remember in the old days where we had calculators and people used to add up on calculators?
Yes, I do.
Well, I think some of those used to be made by the NCR Corporation. And in its early days, the president, owner of the NCR, if he didn't like you, would tell you your job was over, and then he would take your desk outside and have it set on fire. And so that's some people have a theory. And let me just finish with this fascinating anecdote. I know you had a pressing question, Dave, but this part's important. One of the people he let go in this manner, see, let go is a much nicer way of saying fired, was Thomas Watson. And Thomas Watson went on to, in essence, found IBM. And he set fire to Tom Watson's desk as well. Not the golfer, but the computer guy.
Yeah, computer geek, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we called them geeks.
Well, back then they didn't call them geeks. I did not know that, but I guess I suppose that it kind of makes a little sense. But I will Google that just to see if that's right, as I'm sure the audience will as well.
Yeah, and find that I'm making it up entirely.
No, that's good. So what is some, to get back to obviously some practical stuff, what are some key things that employers need to really think about on termination?
Yeah. Let me sort of go to one thing that I really do preach when I work with clients and speak to HR groups is identify the reason for the termination. This may sound obvious, but I've seen this cause many problems. Identify the reason for the termination and stick to the reason and be consistent with that reason. Because when you think about a termination, the explanation gets given in a number of different contexts. It gets given, first of all, in the discussion, usually, by management and perhaps HR before it's executed, before that happens. So, okay, we're going to terminate this person for attendance reasons. And then when I sit down with you, Dave, and I tell you your job's finished, I tell you orally, you've lost your job for attendance reasons. Right. I then also tell you that if I'm exercising good practice through a termination letter, and then I probably tell that to the unemployment people when they ask why you were let go. I may report that back to my boss. So there's a lot of tellings of that story. What we find at times is that employers don't stick to the same message. And so the attendance then becomes, well, they were insubordinate too. And sometimes the attendance drops off by the time you get to unemployment.
It starts adding things in.
Adding, subtracting, yeah. Morphing. And so what a lawyer who's representing that now former employee will do, if there's a claim, is to say they're making this up as they go along. You know, it changes every day. The real reason is this was the only African-American employee on the sales force. This is the oldest woman in the workplace. This person has just come back from a medical leave. This person comes from England, and they're being discriminated against based on their national origin. That happens a lot, by the way.
Well, I was just thinking to myself, that's probably one of the only ones that I'd agree with. But just kidding. It is true.
I do keep a diary, by the way.
No, I do think it's true. I think that it's human behavior when I think about it. I don't think anybody or any employers really like to terminate anybody, to be honest with you.
No.
I know that when I speak to employers, they angst over it. They really do when they have to terminate somebody because they do feel in some ways a failure themselves, right? That they weren't able to get this person to do what it needed to be done. At the same time, they recognize that it just has to be done, so they have to go do it. But they do try to keep validating why they had to do it. So it's not done from a malicious standpoint. They just keep adding things on to really say, hey, I have to validate it again, and here's why.
Yeah, and you're dead right. And the other thing that happens is people try to cushion the blow. So let's say you were really lousy at your job, and that's why I decided to let you go. But instead, I said, Dave, I've decided that we're probably going to make a change, and I'm not sure we really need your position. So you did a great job for us, but sorry. That is easier to deliver. You feel better about it. And then, you're let go, and then 2 weeks later I hire someone who fills your shoes, and you say, hey, hold on a minute, I thought they didn't need my role any longer. So they didn't tell me the truth. So what was the truth? That's another comment.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Out of trying to cushion the blow, people don't describe the real reason.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney with Brown and Isaacson, and we're talking about some updates of 2014 that affect 2015 in regards to employment law. So one of the things that we haven't talked about yet is some things that are going to be happening with immigration and the I-9. Talk to me a little bit about what's going to happen in that area.
Well, in the area of I-9s, and for those who don't know, you know, the I-9 is the form that employers must fill out for every employee that they hire. And there's a federal agency, has the nice acronym ICE, I-C-E, who will come knocking at your door to audit. You may be picked on a random basis. You may be picked because they're criteria. But they're certainly out there, and they're certainly enforcing the immigration laws. And if you look at the statistics and activity, they're only increasing both the number of audits, the fines that they're imposing, the action they're taking. So I think that employers all have to be prepared that it could be their turn. So in discussing this with employers and with clients, it's the self-audit is the issue that people should be focusing on. Anytime I've had somebody I've represented audited, invariably they say, gosh, if only we could put the clock back a week or 2 weeks and have done our own self-audit before the agents arrived and asked for our paperwork. One thing for folks to remind themselves about is that the I-9 goes back to 1986. So here in Maine, you know, we have the benefit of some really long service employees and loyal employees. But if they're still employed in 2015, but they were hired after 1986, you may only be as compliant as your paperwork was in the late 80s or the 90s or 2000 or 2001. So a lot of employers may be under the belief that, you know, we've got someone really good doing that now, and we understand, and we've heard the trainings, and we're checking the right boxes, and we're using the new form, but they might overlook the fact that the audit can go back a long, long way. I actually have a colleague who really specializes in this area and does a lot of work, and he was saying to me the other day, he's done a number of self-audits for clients, and the non-compliant rate was well over 50% for the documents that he was looking at. And it can be, there's two types. There's what we call a technical or procedural violation, which is curable and not a big deal. And then there's substantive violations, and those can result in large fines. And you know, examples are when the form hasn't been signed in the right place by the employer, and that can result in the form in essence being defective. The biggest practical issue I would suggest to employers is if you have 100 employees, you would want to go and look at your I-9s and see that you have 100 I-9s. That's, you know,
That's the starting place.
And absolutely, then there's other things. So it's an area, again, where the administration, we know that they have not been able to pursue their legislative agenda in immigration, and so the administration has been doing things through either regulation or through executive order, and it's a balancing act between their agenda politically and indicating that we are enforcing existing laws. And they are enforcing existing laws, particularly as they pertain to employers. So,
you know, one of the questions that has come up that I know is, as we get ready to wrap up the show here, employers ask if an ICE agent arrives at their office and wants to see their I-9s, can they delay them? Do they have to immediately deliver those I-9s to that agent, or can they say, you know, come back in and we'll be happy to provide, as they can in some other cases?
They can come back. What they'll do, in our experience, is the agent will arrive and there's a notice, and the notice has a date when the I-9s must be provided to ICE, and they'll either come back and pick them up or they can be delivered. But there is a window of time. Of course,
everybody fixing them within that window of time is pretty obvious.
Well, you know, you can exercise good faith and make corrections But you have to indicate you've done it at that time. You can't, you know, the biggest mistake, and no one should do it, is to, you know, create I-9s and backdate them and make it look as if you always had them, or right. Those types of things. Then they'll go after you very hard. But it continues to be an area where it impacts every single employer in the state. And if you look at the enforcement activity by ICE, one of the cases was a very small mom-and-pop store. I think it was a convenience store right up on the Canadian border. I think it was in the county. And, you know, one of the owners, who'd been the owner forever, didn't have an I-9. And some people think, well, I'm the owner. You know, I'm not really an employee. Yeah. Well, you are an employee of the corporation. And they came and they imposed fines for that not happening. So, you know, being vigilant, being on top of it remains a high priority, I'd say.
Well, you know, Peter, it's been always a good time having you on the show today, and I really appreciate you providing an update for employers out there. Is there anything else you'd like to just simply let the audience know as we're getting ready to finalize today's show?
Yeah, you've heard this from me before, but when I speak to audiences, and, you know, I work and represent management, and so sometimes I think some people think, gosh, that an employee who's bringing a claim against a business is engaged in, you know, just an opportunistic shakedown, that they're all the same. And I remind audiences, and I say, I've dealt now with I can't name how many, but hundreds and hundreds of employees or former employees who brought claims. The vast majority of them bring the claim because they feel they've been treated unfairly. They really do. And it sounds somewhat trite, but if you can pursue practices that make your employees feel respected and feel that decisions are fair, they may not necessarily agree with them, but if they feel that they're rooted in a fair process, that they've had the opportunity to tell their side of the story, that they've been given due consideration and maybe even a chance to appeal it internally, that goes a long way to prevent claims being filed. If you're an employer and you have to face a claim, you will spend a ton of money, you'll spend a ton of time, it will be distracting, it will take away from your mission. So fairness really does count. It's good business. And so I always convey that message to folks.
And that's really good advice. Peter, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you. My pleasure again.
And now your HR tips for the week. Today we're going to give a quick compilation of 4 HR tips that are provided by HRShield.com. The first, HR tip number 4. Most of the time, your advice will not be well received. If taken into consideration at all, don't get discouraged. HR tip number 10. Approach every investigation in a non-judgmental manner. HR tip number 21. Show your employees just how much you value and appreciate them. And HR tip number 1. Know your business. Those are your HR tips of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, James P. Harris from the law firm Sheehan Finney Bass & Green is an employment attorney and litigator, and he is going to be talking about bulletproofing your HR documentation. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.